Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, and we have the author of In Cheap We Trust, The Story of a Misunderstood American Virtue. Lauren Weber is here this hour, and she talks about the virtues of cheapness, autonomy, independence, a deeper sense of fulfillment, financial security, and a lighter footprint on the world around us. Of course, we have negatively associated cheapness with not being very generous of heart and not being very generous. She looks at the origins of cheapness and also looks at thriftiness and how people through history, the Quakers and the Puritans and Ben Franklin and the thrift societies, and it's just a fascinating look. Plus, her family story is pretty incredible of her father's cheapness. We'll be talking with her about that, and I think we'll get a ton of calls on this issue. Lauren was formerly a staff reporter at Reuters and Newsday. She's written for the New York Times, the LA Times, and other publications. And we'll be welcoming phone calls as we always do. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And, you know, the cheapness that we usually think of is not a very flattering term, but she asks us to imagine cheapness as a new framework for low-cost living, a 21st century version of thrift. Hello, Lauren. Thanks so much for being with us. Lauren? Lauren Weber, can you hear me? No. No, she's... Yeah, we'll try and reach her again. Oh, I didn't know that. She's on a different line here. Okay, now I know. It's my fault. Lauren, hello.
Hi, Kathleen.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know you were on this line. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
The stories that you wrote about your dad are pretty amazing. And if you could tell us some of those, your dad was, and I don't want to use this as an entirely derogatory term because he was also generous, but your dad didn't like to spend money on things that most of us would think are fairly necessary, huh?
Yes, that's true. Actually, he is, he's still the same way. He's alive and well. And the book is dedicated to him, and he's very flattered by that, even though he is getting a little bit famous for trying to ration our family's toilet paper. I grew up in Connecticut, and it's very cold in New England. And when I was growing up, he kept the heat at our house at 50 degrees.
Whoa.
And yes, very cold. I'm sure it gets as cold or colder in Wisconsin. And, you know, I remember being a kid in my house and wearing hats and scarves. I remember doing my homework by the kitchen table at the kitchen table with my hands on the stove and my feet on the radiator trying to stay warm. Yeah, he would, you know, if I was in the shower for more than a few minutes, I'd get a knock on the door and my father would say, Laura, you're using too much water. Some of my friends' favorite stories about my dad are that he doesn't like to use the brakes on his car. He has this system he's devised of light tapping and thrusting that he thinks is better on the brake pads. And of course, he coasts to red lights. I think that's a given. And he also uses hand signals out the window of his car rather than using his car's turn signal. That's another favorite of my friends. And then, of course, there was the time he tried to ration the toilet paper, which I have to say it didn't really work because he couldn't figure out a way to monitor it. So that one fell by the wayside pretty quickly, fortunately.
I'm sure. And why did he have this sense? Were his parents Depression era people or what?
Well, they were. But, you know, and I've asked him this many times, and there's no clear explanation. His parents did live through the Depression. My dad was born in 1943. And they were, you know, lower middle class New Yorkers. They had both been born in the U.S., but their parents had come from Russia, Romania, and Eastern Europe. And they didn't have a lot. My grandfather was a cab driver in New York City. But even though they didn't have a lot, they were two people who appreciated fine things. My grandmother happens to be something of a shopaholic, actually.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. And I think, actually, my dad's frugality or cheapness, whatever you want to call it, is his form of rebellion against his mother in particular. I think his mother was very materialistic and remains so at the age of 93 or so. And my dad just decided that he was going to live his life differently.
Yeah. And what did your dad think of your portrayal of him in this book? Was he embarrassed or does he think it's all right? It's honest.
He feels that it's honest. He, you know, my parents both read the book before it came out, partly because my mother is a copy editor and my father's an economist. And so I wanted my dad to read the sections of the book that were about economic theory and John Maynard Keynes. And I wanted my mom to proofread. And my dad was thrilled with the book. And, you know, he says to me, the one aspect or the one fact that I talk about that he disputes is the heat being at 50 degrees. He said it wasn't that low. Now, my sister and my mother both back me up on this, so I feel confident that I got it right. And he said to me the other day, well, I apologize and I should take you all to a warm place for vacation. And I told a friend of mine this and she said, does he mean the laundry room? You know, figuring that might be warm enough for him. But, you know, he's now retired. He was an economics professor for nearly 40 years. And he's actually he's moderated his money habits a little bit, but he's still the same old frugal and really cheap dad that he always was.
Yeah. But he was also very generous, giving money to charities, etc.
Exactly. And that's one of the main points that I try to bring out in the book. And you know, you mentioned in the introduction the word cheap has a lot of negative connotations. And I use it somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but also sincerely. I think, you know, there's a lot of shame associated with thrift, frugality, cheapness, whatever you want to call it. It's become over our history a quality that we laugh at and make fun of people for or consider eccentric rather than something that we champion, which we did do earlier in our history. And one of the reasons that I'm trying to reclaim history, reclaim the word cheap, and I use my father as kind of my primary example, is because he proves that there's no contradiction between cheapness and generosity. He not only gives money, quite a bit of money, to charities. I think when the Asian tsunami happened a few years ago, he was probably one of the first people to pull out his checkbook. But he also sent my brother and sister and I to very expensive private universities without a word of complaint. My mother as well, of course. You know, there was never a word of complaint from my father about paying these very high tuitions. And I think, you know, okay, he was a little bit crazy if you were in the shower for longer than 5 minutes, but you know, he sort of scrimped on a lot of those little things and some bigger things as well. But it was because he really knew what his priorities were and his values. And one of his priorities was education and another one is social justice. And, you know, that means helping people who are less fortunate.
Right. So how about you, Lauren? Are you like your dad?
I am, yeah. And perhaps I wrote this book in some ways to redeem my own behavior, maybe. I wouldn't say I'm nearly as extreme as my father, but, you know, I made fun of him like everybody else in my family, and I also complained a lot about some of his habits when I was growing up. But then when I started supporting myself and, you know, realized what goes into doing that, I think I actually adopted quite a few of his habits. And when I moved to Seattle after I graduated from college, I lived with my boyfriend and I wouldn't let him turn the heat above 60 degrees. So, you know, I was a little bit better, but I think I still imposed some of my own cheapness on some people around me. But, you know, one reason why I think cheapness or thrift or frugality, again, I use those words sort of interchangeably, is a very positive quality is that it has bought me a lot of, as you said earlier, autonomy, self-determination. Because I live frugally, I've been able to do work that I love and basically write this book because I took 2 years off from paid work in order to do that.
Mm-hmm. I was a little worried about you, though, in the time when you were, what was it, 7-year-old or maybe 5-year-old? Was it clams? A thing?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Oh, that story made me go, oh, my gosh, I hope you didn't get really sick from it.
No, that was either a low mark or a high mark, depending on how you look at it. While I was writing the book, I was living extremely frugally, more than I ever had before. I even started making my own laundry detergent. I basically lived on lentils and beans. And one day I was going through my pantry thinking I would eat some of the older things that were in there so that I wouldn't have to do more shopping. And I had a can of baby clams that had been there for, I think, probably 7 years. And I decided to make pasta with clam sauce, and I got the garlic simmering in the oil, and I opened the clams, and they're kind of greenish blue,
yeah.
And they didn't smell great. And I just couldn't bring myself to throw them away. And I ended up making my pasta sauce, and I'm sitting at my kitchen table eating it. And I'm looking up the symptoms of botulism on my laptop. So, you know, that was sort of when I realized, okay, maybe went too far this time. I probably wouldn't do that again. But, you know that instinct not to throw things out, not to waste, comes partly from my dad, but also partly from experiences I've had in my life. One of the ways that I spend my money is on travel, and I've been to many developing countries like India, Cuba, Vietnam. And when you see incredible poverty like that, I think it really does make you think twice about how quick we are to throw things out in this culture. And, I sort of always have that in the back of my mind.
Yeah, that's very true. So tell me about the word. How did we get the word cheap? Was it always a negative connotation to the word?
No, it actually started out as a sort of neutral term. In Middle English, it meant a bargain. You know, people would say a good cheap. It meant a good bargain. It wasn't until maybe the 1700s or 1800s that it took on a negative spin and started to mean something that was poorly made, or refer as an adjective to a person, meaning miserly or stingy. There was a term in the 1800s in America called a cheap jack or a cheap John, and that was slang for somebody who sold secondhand goods. And that was sort of one of the turning points in the way we used the word cheap. It started to mean sort of shoddy products.
Hmm. And tell me about Ben Franklin, what he wrote, and this idea that thrift is a means to independence and to freedom, which you've said is true for your life, how he became associated perhaps with the folksiness and the importance of American thrift.
Yeah, he's probably our favorite American apostle of thrift. But I should add, he didn't always take his own advice.
Right.
He was quite profligate when he was older. Of course, he had the means to afford to do that. But he was known when he was a diplomat in England and France for sending home crates of expensive fabrics for curtains in his home in Philadelphia. And he liked fine wines and things like that. But I think he had a very genuine appreciation for thrift and a passionate advocacy for it, not so much in the Puritan sense. You know, Puritans sort of pushed the idea that thrift was good for the soul, that one should be focused on God, not on material things. But Ben Franklin was much more pragmatic than that. And he and many other patriots at the time believed that thrift was critical to building an American economy. They believed that if Americans could work hard, be industrious, and save their money, that money would then be the capital that they could invest to till a new field or to open a new factory, a new workshop, hire more apprentices, that it was really a cornerstone value for building an economy that would be independent from England and independent from Europe. So he really had a whole political economy that incorporated the idea of frugality. And, you know, of course, he's famous for phrases like a penny saved is a penny earned. He didn't necessarily write those himself. He was very good at compiling aphorisms from other sources and putting them into his Poor Richard's Almanac, which is how a lot of them got popularized.
And did the Almanac have advice for how to be able to be thrifty?
Oh, yeah. Almanacs are very funny to read. They were technically there to give moon cycles, agricultural advice, weather, almost always wrong. Totally inaccurate, these almanacs, when it came to really the important stuff. But they often also had jokes in them, poems, and then little household tips sort of tucked in among the, cycles of the moon charts. So there would be tips on how to get rid of roaches in your house, or how to preserve eggs for a longer time, or preserve fresh butter. Just little tips on how to save money, ways to sort of home apothecary type things, how to cure dysentery at home. Had something to do with cayenne pepper.
Let's talk about savings accounts and about saving, because we are living in this society where we don't save very much. Maybe it's hard for us too. I thought it was really fascinating. I never knew that savings banks were philanthropic organizations initially. Tell me how they started, who started them, and who started the idea of really getting the American public to save.
Sure. You know, I think there were banks for wealthier people that extended further back. Often, you know, wealthy people used commercial banks, but savings banks, the kinds of banks that served, you know, small depositors, didn't really arrive in the U.S. until the early 1800s. They were generally started by wealthy philanthropists in different cities. Philadelphia, Boston, New York all had some of the earliest banks. And they were basically meant as a cure for urban poverty. Many wealthy people were very concerned, especially after the revolution was supposed to sort of deliver us this free and perfect republic, a perfect union, and it didn't. There was still a huge amount of paupers living in the streets, you know, asking for money. It was considered kind of a blight on the ideals that America had been founded on. And so some of these wealthy people, wealthy individuals, started savings banks in order to give you know, working class people, workers, tradesmen, sailors, seamstresses, a place where they could save their money and earn a little bit of interest. And it was not just a practical thing, you know, that you could have a safe place to keep your money, but also in the kind of very moralistic language of the time, these individuals believed that savings banks could imbue poor people with a spirit of virtue. And the idea was if they could learn how to save, they would learn frugality, they would learn virtue, they would learn sobriety, because alcoholism was a big problem at the time. So there was a lot of moralizing attached to this very practical idea.
Mm. A practical idea that even Albert Einstein took up. Never forget how important compound interest is, right?
That's right, right. I think, well, there's a rumor that he called compound interest the most powerful force in the universe, apparently more powerful than gravity. But no one's ever confirmed that. We're not sure if he actually said that.
Oh, really?
Huh. Yeah. But I'd like to think so.
Yeah, yeah, I kind of like that too. Mm-hmm. Let's welcome phone calls. Our guest is Lauren Weber. Her book is In Cheap We Trust, The Story of a Misunderstood American Virtue. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A reminder to you to listen to our healthcare panel tomorrow. We are broadcasting from Frater to Cancer Center tomorrow, and it'll be a full 2 hours with 8 guests. So it's slightly different than our normal format, but we will have people from we'll have the Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. We'll have a Democratic member of the Wisconsin State Senate, a Republican member of the same organization, the VP of External Advocacy for GlaxoSmithKline, the President and CEO of Bellin Health in Green Bay, the President and CEO of Milwaukee Health Services, servicing Central City residents for the most part, a president of Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield in Wisconsin, and the chief executive officer of the Medical College Physicians of Wisconsin. So it's really a good panel. We asked for people to call in. We got all the seats. They're free, but people said they were going to be there in large numbers. So I'm not sure you could get a seat if you showed up, but you can certainly listen. Full 2 hours, all of those guests tomorrow from 9 to 11. All right, let's go to phone calls for our guest. Our number, 800-486-8655. Lauren Weber is her name, and Joey is our first caller. Hi, Joey.
Hi.
Hi.
My mom told me a funny story about my grandfather when he died. It was in the 60s, and she was cleaning out his desk, and in the bottom right drawer there was a old cigar box with a piece of masking tape over the top, and on the masking tape it read, "String, too short to use." And sure enough, when you open it up, there was a bunch of short string in there that he couldn't use, but he couldn't throw it away either.
Oh, my gosh. There must be a use for it somewhere, Lorna.
Out of use for those pieces of string, but I would say, not a totally uncommon thing to do. And hoarding is something that comes along with thrift. It's sort of one of the more extreme versions of, you know, being unable to throw anything out because you think everything might have a use. And I respect, you know, a more moderate version of that, I think, is wonderful. Much of frugality is about using things well, getting, you know, full value out of things. But, you know, the string too short to use, you know, in the end, I'm not sure who that helps.
What did your mom do with it?
I don't know, but Part of the story I didn't tell you, he was a butcher, so they used a lot of string. So
out
of defense, you know, maybe it was too short to wrap meat in. And
maybe he could have tied all of the little pieces together and eventually used it, you know, for one big piece of string.
That's a great story.
All right.
I actually heard a story from one person about his grandmother who would save ice cubes out of people's cups, you know, after they were finished drinking. She would take the ice cubes and put them back in the freezer.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
You know, and for a long time in America, and it's still true now for a lot of people, is that you have to be cheap or you have to be frugal. It's a matter of survival.
Yeah. And that was the case through much of our history. Thrift was more of a necessity than necessarily a virtue. I mean, it was often something that Americans admired, thanks to Ben Franklin's advocacy and others, but it wasn't necessarily something they aspired to. And, you know, what I found in my research is that as soon as Americans' incomes rose and as soon as they had greater access to credit, whether that meant installment plans in the 1850s or credit cards in the 1950s, they generally took advantage of it.
Yeah. Tell us some of the stories. We always love those stories where you hear somebody's died and they all of a sudden you find out that they were a multimillionaire and they've given all their money to research for some disease or to a school. And you think, oh, my gosh. Or people who saved absolutely everything and made this enormous donation after they died. You have some stories in the book. What's her first name? Ms. Green.
Hetty Green.
Hetty Green. Tell some of these people who are very, very wealthy, and yet they're wearing the same outfit, you know, holes in the shoe for years.
Yeah, she was a financier who was born in the 1800s and died in 1916. She grew up in a wealthy family and inherited some money from her father, who had been whaling whaling entrepreneurs in Massachusetts. And so she inherited some money and ended up being a railroad financier. She was just a huge figure on Wall Street. You don't hear too much about women on Wall Street in the late 1800s and early 1900s. But she was given the nickname the Witch of Wall Street because she apparently would walk around Lower Manhattan wearing the same black dress until it basically fell apart into threads. She had kept all of her accounts at Chemical Bank, and because she didn't want to rent her own office, she basically took over a corner of the Chemical Bank building in New York, and they just gave her a desk. And according to legend, she would bring in a pail of cold oatmeal and heat it up on the radiator for her lunch rather than go out to a restaurant. Now, she died in 1916 with leaving $100 million to her two children, which at the time was worth about $2 billion in today's dollars. So she was very extreme. She was a source of surreal fascination. She was always being followed by reporters. You know, people couldn't understand how somebody with so much money could live so cheaply. I mean, she was sort of famous for living in unheated tenement buildings in Brooklyn and Hoboken, New Jersey, and taking public ferries from Hoboken, New Jersey to Lower Manhattan to go to her office. You know, she was clearly a bit compulsive about it, but she also had a sense of humor about it. And when reporters did actually catch up with her and interview her, she was very funny. And, you know, she said, this was during the Gilded Age. She said, you know, I know that some people prefer high society. That's just not important to me.
Let's go to Beth from Denmark next. Hi, Beth.
Hi, those are awesome stories. The one I have, I'll share about my dad, who was born in the 30s, 1931. So he would get, my dad and my aunt would get one candy bar a week, and my aunt would gobble hers up instantly. And my dad would cut his into 7 slices, and he would eat one slice a day, or he would dole them out to my aunt so she would do his chores for him.
Oh, my gosh. That is amazing.
And the long end of the story is that he saved so much, and then he passed away when I was 11 and left me a trust, so I was able to go to college, pay for a few cars, have some good running cars, help pay for a wedding, help pay for some home renovations, and pay for the adoption of our 3 children. So all of those things made such a huge impact on me.
That is an incredible story. And actually, it reminds me of something that's in the book. I have a chapter on cheapskate psychology, and where I look at some of the theories on why frugal people are the way they are. And there is a famous experiment, social experiment from the 1960s by a psychologist at Stanford and named Walter Mischel, I think. It's known as the marshmallow experiment. And basically in the 60s, they took a bunch of four-year-olds, I think, and gave them all a marshmallow. And they said to them, if you can wait 20 minutes to eat your marshmallow, you'll get another one at the end of the 20 minutes. And naturally, some of the kids ate their marshmallow immediately, and some of the kids managed to save their marshmallow. And I thought it was adorable. He says that they saved it by doing little things. You know, they tried to distract themselves. They would sing to themselves. Some of them tried to fall asleep. It's just so cute to sort of imagine them sitting there with their little marshmallows and trying to take a nap. And then this experiment tracked these kids and found that the ones who were who showed self-control and, you know, delayed their gratification turned out to be much more successful in life in general. They had higher scores on the SAT. They were better adjusted and they were happier. So it sounds like your dad would have fit into that category for sure.
Yeah. Thanks so much for the call. Is the story about your sister? What's the story which, you know, it's true when people spend wildly and fulfill their every wish, then they have no treats. I think it was a cookie. Is it your sister? Who used to get a cookie?
Sister.
Yeah. Tell that story.
Yeah, you know, my sister and I are very similar, and we both are quite similar to my father, and so we like to tell each other, you know, our different cheap stories. One thing that she says in talking about delayed gratification is that things are more valuable. The treats that she allows herself mean so much more to her and feel so much more special if they are a reward for something or if she waited for them, you know. And so she uses the example of how she's a professor in Chicago, and if she, you know, does something she was procrastinating, like she writes her syllabus for her class, she'll reward herself with, say, a cookie and, you know, spend a lot of time thinking about the cookie and choosing her cookie. And then when she has it, she, you know, it's such a special treat to her. And I do think that when you're so used to kind of indulging, I mean, I believe in enjoying yourself. We only live once. And I believe in every now and then having a really expensive restaurant meal or buying a great pair of winter boots. But I think if you make a habit out of eating expensive meals or just kind of indulging your every whim, after a while, it seems less and less special. Or it seems to me that it would be that way. I've never really gotten to that point. So, you know, I think I appreciate all of the little treats that I give myself because I think they are kind of out of the ordinary for me.
Huh. You see, I'm kind of a firm believer in a cookie a day. So, and to me, it's still special. I look forward to it, but
that's great.
You know, give me one every day. That's all right, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is all right. You know, everybody has their little things, but I think if you know, every time you walked by, you know, a display of cookies and had 10 of them, you know, it might start to seem less special. Maybe you just dole yours out on a day-by-day basis rather than a week-by-week basis.
Priscilla is next from Green Bay. Hi, Priscilla.
Hi. We're just traveling through, almost on our way home to Green Bay. Anyway, this summer we were visiting Manchester, New Hampshire, and we visited the Credit Union Museum. That's where the Credit Union started. And the owner of the textile mill to help the poor people, and they didn't want to go across the river to the bank. They felt out of place, and they didn't have much money. So he started the credit union in his home, and the people would come, and maybe they deposit a dollar or 50 cents or something, and that's how the credit union got started. And I thought that was so interesting to see this owner of the textile mill helping the poor people.
Yeah, I didn't do too much research on credit unions, but I think that is a common story, and they served in many ways a similar purpose as savings banks. But I think, you know, because often they were based around a workplace or a union and things like that, they tended to have a lot of loyalty and great programs to reward their members. Yeah, I think it's a wonderful, wonderful concept, and it's great that some industrialists in America chose to do that for their workers.
That's right. And we're having a really nice time driving through this country here.
Great.
That's great.
Thanks very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Lauren Weber is our guest, and her book is In Cheap We Trust, The Story of a Misunderstood American Virtue. Let's go back to some of the early pioneers of this country. I was interested in the Puritans and in the Quakers and their different ideas about thrift, etc. But the Puritans, was it the Puritans who gave us this, it was really a tax, a consumption tax to keep people from going too far?
Right. Yeah. Sumptuary laws.
Sumptuary laws. Yeah.
Yeah. I hadn't realized that we had had them in the U.S. They were common in the Middle Ages. They were imposed by the Catholic Church to keep people from spending too much. The idea being that people spent too much on themselves, they weren't giving enough money to the church. But it turned out we had them in the U.S. as well in the early 1600s, around 1634, I think, in Massachusetts. John Cotton was a Puritan minister, and he helped pass some sumptuary laws. Basically, you know, as I said, the Puritan idea was that if you were focused too much on material and worldly goods, then you weren't paying enough attention to God. And the idea back then was that life on earth was supposed to be a lot of hard work and prayer, and you enjoyed your rewards in the afterlife, not in this life. And unfortunately for John Cotton and some of the other Puritan leaders, they found that America was such an abundant land. I mean, when they got here, it took incredible hard work and perseverance to create settlements. But once they did, you know, there was just so much abundance here in terms of arable land and fish. I mean, I read that there were 6-foot lobsters washing up on shore back in the old colonies. So, you know, there was a lot of opportunities for prosperity. And what they found was that Americans were indulging. Once they started to make more money, they were wearing fancy clothing, fancy wigs, you know, building or ordering furniture from Europe that was sort of too ornate for the Puritan sensibility. Mm-hmm. And so they tried to legislate frugality by passing these sumptuary laws that basically said things like, you know, you can only wear 2 ruffles on your shirt, not 4 ruffles, or your breeches need to be made out of cotton and linen, not velvet. And, you know, what they found was that this basically backfired. Colonists resented it and basically didn't even observe it. You know, they would just sort of break the laws fairly indiscriminately, and eventually they just rescinded the laws because they could tell it wasn't working. Mm. And, you know, history, that's what history proves over the last 300 years. You can't really legislate people's behavior in this particular area.
Yeah. Was there, as you studied all of this, was there an era throughout history in which you would have been more at ease? We still live in a consumerist society, I think, in many ways, although it's changing somewhat because of the economy. But was there a time that you think you might have fit in better?
Well, you know, I might have fit in better in most periods before the 1920s. That's really sort of the emergence of consumer society in America. After World War I, there were a lot of innovations that came out of the war that were used for consumer goods like Pyrex and plastic, things like that. So I might have fit in morally, theoretically, before then. But, you know, I don't think I would have wanted to live in that time. As I was doing my research, I read a lot about, you know, daily life in the 1800s or early years of America. And life was hard, really hard. You know, this was a time when women spent their days, you know, at the stream pounding their laundry, or, you know, they were working from 4:30 in the morning when they would wake up and milk the cows to like 11 o'clock at night. I read one diary of a farm wife who basically would write in her diary that she couldn't wait to die because then she could rest for all eternity.
Oh.
And, you know, when you read that, it's like, OK, I can't blame her for wanting a washing machine, you know, or wanting some of the comforts of a consumer society. The thing is, though, things like a washing machine or even a car were real quality of life improvements for people up to a certain point. But then we got to, I don't know, maybe the 50s or 60s or 70s, certainly the 80s, and we're no longer, when we talk about buying things, we're no longer talking, for the most part, about real quality of life improvements. We're just talking about, you know, having another sweater to add to our 20 in the closet. You know, so it's not that I would have liked to have lived back in the days when more Americans were frugal. I think they were frugal because they just couldn't afford to live otherwise.
Let's go to Terry from Willard. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I really would like to thank you for this program, bringing these values up. I actually feel embarrassed at times, you know, trying to share some ideas, which I do for environmental reasons, but to ask guests, you know, not to flush a toilet for a couple ounces of urine, you know, that will, you know, using so much clean water just to, for our sanitation purposes. And I just think that this is a really great program. And yeah, we've actually disconnected our shower so that it runs it, so that we use our gray water from the shower to flush the toilet to save more water. Like you say, you don't, you know, if it's yellow, let it mellow. And it just seems like it's just something that we need to hear more of.
Thank you. Yeah, I agree. I think my father would be a very, you'd be very happy to have my father as a guest at your house, or me too. I actually agree with you. I think we've gotten so used to convenience and sort of sanitizing everything looking to make our lives easier in every way. And not that that's always a bad thing, but I think we have maybe gotten a little bit soft about some of these things. And, you know, certainly I wrote the book so that people like the caller don't have to feel ashamed. I'd like to restore some of the respect to values like frugality and thrift. I think, you know, as I said, it used to be considered a heroic virtue in our country. And then at some point, it became kind of a punchline, something that we make fun of people for, and something that people feel a little bit ashamed of. And I certainly I'm familiar with that shame. I mean, I live in New York City, and in New York, it's very difficult to socialize without going out to eat because everybody's apartments are so small. So I have some friends who have very good jobs, and they'll say, oh, you know, they'll mention a restaurant, and I'm kind of embarrassed to say, you know, can we go somewhere that's a little less expensive? And, you know, at a certain point, I thought, why do I feel embarrassed about that? First of all, I don't earn as much money as some of them. And it seems perfectly reasonable to me to have other priorities besides, you know, having probably a forgettable meal that's going to cost me $50. I'd rather save that money and use it to go on a trip, you know, the next year, or visit India or a place like that. So I think so much of it is about having values and priorities and trying not to feel too swept up in this consumer culture.
Yeah. Well, and you lighten your footprint in a significant way if a lot of people do that.
Exactly. You know, I think that's part of the argument that's very powerful right now. It might have meant less maybe 10 years ago, but now people are thinking a lot about global warming and climate change and their footprint on the environment. You know, I sometimes say it's a little bit glib, but cheap is the new green. It's, you know, the less money you spend, the fewer resources you consume for the most part. You know, we send millions and millions of pounds of textile waste to landfills every year, whereas if we just shopped in thrift stores more, you know, it's one way to recycle those textiles rather than having to throw them out. Not to mention, it's also easier on your wallet. And that's the case with so many of these things. It's about living in a way that's easier on your wallet and easier on the environment.
Thanks, Terry. Let's go to Barbara next from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, Joyce. I have a question for your gal. I'm really enjoying the show. I have noticed that a lot of what you, when you guys were talking about, like the candy bar and seven pieces and being rewarded with a cookie, you sound just like my weight loss group that I talk to. You know, being very conscious of what you're eating and giving yourself little rewards. So my question is, for the author is, have you noticed a correlation between a person's weight and their frugality? Because I think they probably would be linked in some way.
You know, it's a great question. I haven't specifically noticed that, but I have a feeling if I did some studies, I probably would find that. I mean, I think people who are frugal, one of the main strategies is to cook your own food. That generally means staying away from fast food or convenience foods or, you know, having a candy bar just when you're a little bit peckish or hungry. And so I think you'd probably find that people who cook at home more often eat healthier and maybe are more fit because of that. I also, you know, because I try to keep my own expenses down pretty low, I think I might have said earlier, I practically live on lentils and beans. And these are two of the highest protein, lowest calorie, lowest fat foods imaginable. And they're also unbelievably cheap. So, you know, through eating the way I do, I think I probably also keep my weight down that way.
Thanks for the call. We'll take more phone calls in just one moment. Our guest this hour, author of In Cheap We Trust, The Story of a Misunderstood American Virtue, Lauren Weber, is with us. And here's our number, 800-486-8655. One line is open. Or if you want to, you could send an email, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow is our two-hour remote broadcast on healthcare reform. It will be from Frater. We're taking the show to Frater, the new cancer center. We will have a live audience, which is pretty filled, so we can't assure you a seat should you decide to come tomorrow. But we have 2 hours of the same 8 guests, so it's a different kind of show. We wanted to make sure that we covered all kinds of aspects of this healthcare reform debate. So we will have with us the CEO of the Medical College Physicians of Wisconsin, president of Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield in Wisconsin. We will talk with the president and CEO of Milwaukee Health Services, the president and CEO of Bellin Health in Green Bay, the vice president of external advocacy for GlaxoSmithKline. We'll talk with Republican Wisconsin State Senator, Senator Mary Lazick, and Democratic State Senator John Urbanbach, and the Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services will also join us. It should be a good show tomorrow. As you know, we've been spending a lot of time on healthcare reform issues. Tomorrow, everybody's there, 8 people, 2 hours, plus you. Good questions. So please listen. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Our next guest is Jeff, who's driving through Wisconsin from Atlanta. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you doing today?
All right, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Good.
My question was, has the author done any research into the role of credit cards and spending habits of the people in this country? Because I guess it's my perception that was sort of a turning point in maybe thrift in this country.
That's a really interesting question. And yeah, credit cards came around. I think the first one was brought into being. It was Diners Club in 1950. And that is right around the time that you really see a cultural shift from viewing frugality as an ideal, a national virtue, to seeing it as an eccentricity and even as a danger to our country, because it was considered a danger to the economy if people weren't spending. You know, right now, credit card debt in this country averages about $10,000 per household. And I think that's just, you know, people are really, really trapped underneath that debt load. And, you know, I try to go beyond sort of the surface with that issue, because I don't think it's just about people having no self-control and buying too many lattes and too many flat screen TVs. You know, the fact is we are in that situation partly because the financial industry was deregulated in the 1980s and 1990s. It allowed it allowed banks to take on much more risk and loan out a lot more money. And so credit was just too easy to come by. I mean, I don't know about all of you out there, but I was getting God knows how many credit card offers in the mail every week. I had an editor once whose 2-year-old daughter received a credit card offer. You know, there was just too much credit out there. And, you know, many people were taking advantage of it. And we would have benefited had people shown a little more restraint. But I think in many ways, people were just taking their cues from, you know, politicians and economists and bankers and lenders who didn't want the party to end.
Well, I guess, you know, to carry it a step further, maybe within your own family, how did your father work with credit cards and deal with credit cards? And has it become sort of a generational thing in a negative way with a lot of families who basically use it, overuse it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it has with a lot of families. I mean, you know, so much of the way we learn about money management comes from our families. And so if you grew up with parents who didn't necessarily save money or allowed themselves to get into debt, then I think that's the example that you probably live by yourself. But in my family, as you can probably imagine, my father, my parents pay off their credit cards every month, and I do the same thing. It's sort of like, over my dead body, will I actually pay, interest or a late fee and things like that? I feel that that's almost like burning money. Credit cards are a huge problem in this country. And I think the credit squeeze that we're going through right now, there are a lot of painful things about it, but I think one good thing is that banks just won't lend as much to individuals, and that will force a lot of people to cut back a little bit more.
Thanks, Jeff, so much for calling. Let's go to Mike from Cushing. Hi, Mike.
Hi. This is an interesting program. My mother-in-law and another woman of that generation back in the 40s probably actually took the liner out of cereal boxes to reuse them because there wasn't such thing as saran wrap and things like that to use to store things, to store cookies or whatever in. So that was one way.
Wow.
And also, we also collect water off our roof into a 300-gallon tank that we can use then in the garden, so it just doesn't run off someplace. So.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah. That's great. I mean, people are so resourceful, and reporting this story was so much fun because I heard a lot of stories like that. And, I want to also point out that you can tell from all the callers that a lot of people live frugally. I think when I first started writing the book, a friend suggested that I call it Thrift, A Short History of a Dying Virtue. But the more reporting I did and talking to people, I mean, almost everybody I mentioned the book to would say, oh, you should interview my husband, my boss, my daughter, my grandmother, you should interview me. And it just became clear that thrift was not dead or dying at all. It just, I think it kind of went underground. Like an earlier caller said, we attached a certain amount of shame to this. And I think I also might have said, I think that is coincided with the 50s and the real emergence of this consumer society. It really happened after World War II. That economists and politicians were very concerned about plunging into another depression once the stimulus program known as World War II ended. And this was not an unreasonable concern. The Great Depression had only ended a few years before. So they felt that the way to avoid that would be to use all of the capacity that had been developed during the war to make consumer goods. And you needed people to buy those consumer goods. So around the mid-40s, late-40s, and early-50s, there's just this huge push by leaders in all different areas, all different fields, to get people to take seriously the idea that spending money was patriotic and that you had to do it to prop up the American economy. And I think that's an idea that Americans have really internalized. And one example of that I like to bring up is that I don't think it's a coincidence that Scrooge McDuck, who was the miserly uncle of Donald Duck, was invented in 1947. He made his first appearance in 1947, and that really coincides with the sort of new imperative that spending money was good. It was good for us as individuals, and it was good for the economy, and that being frugal was dangerous for America.
Interesting.
And something to be ashamed of.
And then we went through, was it the 80s or into the 90s, where people were building these McMansions and, 3, 4, 5-car garages and all these cars and just this ostentatious display of wealth that was so, and we see the remnants of it. People are moving out now because of the economy and all the space they used. And look at me, I got money.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was the whole greed is good ethic that came from the movie Wall Street, really sort of captured that idea. I think we went overboard. But the thing is, then we had a recession in, I think it was 91, 92. And, people vow we're never going to do that again. And then the tech boom happened and, people built even bigger mansions. And then September 11th happened and we vowed, ostentation is out and overspending is out. And now it's sort of all about being earnest and being with your family all the time. And then look what happened. We had the real estate boom. And so you can see in history this cycle of exuberant bubbles and then painful busts. And we don't quite seem to learn our lesson that when times are good is when we should be saving money, not charging up the credit cards. instead, you know, that might mean that when times are good, the economy won't grow quite as fast. But, you know, that's the time when people should be saving money, is so that then they can weather the downtimes,
right,
which inevitably do come.
Probably time for one more call. Terry from Madison. Hi.
Hi. Great show. I really enjoyed it. I just want to tell you quickly about my childhood. I grew up in Central Maine, very, very frugal family. And I just wanted to mention that there is a dark side to resourcefulness, because I thought oftentimes my dad would take advantage of, you know, generous return policies, like returning his L.L. Bean boots, and they're 35 years old, and they had a lifetime warranty, and they offered to resole them, and he said no, he wanted all new boots. Well, I think that was taking advantage. As a child, I would always go with him to garage sales, and he would look for Craftsman tools that were broken, buy them for 50 cents, and then return them to the store because they had a lifetime warranty.
Oh, so. No.
And how
so
are
there
you
was right? A little bit of shame, you know, associated with that resourcefulness for me, but as I grow older, I'm very thrifty.
Hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think this is why cheap sometimes gets a bad name, is because we think of people who sort of take advantage of others, or maybe your dad taking advantage of these generous return policies. I'm very familiar with the L.L. Bean return policy, and have realized that, oh, I could look for things like that at thrift stores where I do almost all my shopping, and then return them for new things to L.L. Bean, but I don't do that. I sort of believe in, I'm sure your dad was a very good man in many, many ways, but I sort of believe that partly in order to rehabilitate this virtue, it requires being, scrupulously honest about it, too. My father is, if a restaurant overcharges him by accident, as cheap as he is, he'll always point out the error and pay the higher bill.
Wow. And on that note, we say goodbye. Thanks, Lauren. Lauren Weber, our guest. The book is In Cheap We Trust, The Story of a Misunderstood American Virtue. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to John Treader for on-air production in our Milwaukee studios, and thanks, everybody, for your entertaining calls and serious calls. We'll be with you again tomorrow. I'll remind your health care for 2 hours from Frederick Cancer Center. This is the Ideas Network.